From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. It's Wednesday morning as I record this, the morning after an historic election. And by the time you're listening to this on Saturday morning, I have no idea what reality we'll be living in. But one thing is for sure. We will cook, we will eat, we'll do dishes, and we'll find pleasure in these activities and the loved ones we share them with. This may seem counterintuitive, but when I'm stressed, I find great solace in knowing I'm just a speck in the cosmos. When I was teaching food studies at UCLA, my course was called We Are Stardust, A Moral Ecology of Food. The cosmos lives in our soils and in us. This was on my mind when I was reading Sandra Katz's newest book, Fermentation as Metaphor. Fermentation is a subject ripe with insights about humanity and the human-planet cosmos connection, both physically and metaphorically. We ferment foods, but really, life is a ferment. Just look at this past week. There is fermentation going on in us and around us all the time. Sandra Alex Katz's life work of researching and teaching ferments has led him to examine the richness of fermentation as metaphor, which puts many of our current concerns into perspective. Hi, Sandor.
Hi, Evan.
It's so great to have you back. How quickly did you start to see the metaphorical implications of fermentation?
I mean, I would say that, I sort of always was seeing them, but I would also point out that, I didn't make them up in my imagination. You know, really for hundreds of years in the English language, we've been using fermentation both to describe the literal process of, yeast and bacteria transforming nutrients in foods and beverages, but also to describe, really any kind of phenomenon that is sort of, bubbly and dynamic. I started noticing as soon as I became obsessed with all things fermented, I'd be reading an article about some genre of music and they'd talk about a period of musical fermentation. And, so it's sort of built into the word in the English language are these metaphorical understandings of fermentation.
I would love if you could ruminate a bit about the ideas of hard boundaries, something we see all around us politically and socially right now, these borders. How does the study of fermentation blow up the idea of immutable boundaries?
Certainly the microscopy, completely explodes the idea of hard boundaries. And under a microscope, when you look at, a membrane that, we might imagine to be a hard, rigid membrane, a boundary, we can see that it is permeable and that there's all kinds of smaller structures on it. And if we could go even closer, we would see that on the structures, there are further structures. And I think that, the more we begin to understand the complexity of life and how much interaction there is among different life forms, the more concepts like the individual and the skin, the more they become abstracted. And, sure, we have a skin and that functions as a membrane that keeps certain things out, but there's always things that are passing through it. And that's just true of every kind of membrane, every kind of border, every kind of line. It's an abstraction. And I think that, bearing this in mind is really important, with all of the political issues that we're dealing with, whether it's blue states and red states, whether it's male and female, there are always people that don't fit into these categories. And we have to, we have to always remember that we can't reduce lived reality to the sort of simplicity of the categories that we create.
Could you speak to ferment and the now unfamiliar concept of waiting?
Time is a very important variable in fermentation. And I mean, there are fermentations that occur in a matter of a few hours, such as, for instance, yogurt. You know, there are other fermentation processes that take a year or longer, such as soy sauce or miso. There are a lot of ferments that exist somewhere between that, you know, let's say sauerkraut. But, you know, there's not a fixed length of time that I could tell you that sauerkraut takes because, well, one variable is temperature and the metabolism of the organism goes faster when it's warmer and more slowly when it's cooler. But also the, you know, the flavor that people like varies. And so, you know, the sour flavor of sauerkraut is a manifestation of lactic acid that's produced over the course of the fermentation. Well, if you ferment it for a long time, you're going to have more of an accumulation of lactic acid. If you ferment it for a shorter time, you're going to have less of an accumulation of lactic acid. So, you know, depending on the flavor that you like, you can ferment anything for a longer time or a shorter time. But as you point out, waiting is not something that, you know, necessarily comes easily to people. And so, you know, fermentation can be challenging for people, but also fermentation can be an amazing, you know, gift in terms of, you know, sort of forcing people to slow down a little bit, to delay gratification, to do things today that you're going to be able to enjoy weeks or months from now.
Maybe it's the gift that sourdough is giving us during this period of time, the gift of learning patience.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Well, I mean, one other thing related to time is all the time I meet people who tell me like, oh, my life is too busy for any of that. And I mean, you know, I get it. People have very, very busy lives. But let's say your sauerkraut is going to ferment for 3 weeks. Like, you don't have to sit there watching it for the whole 3 weeks. You know, you can spend, you know, 20 minutes shredding the cabbage and salting it, and then you can pack it into whatever your fermentation vessel is, and then you can go about your business, and you can do all the things that are making you busy. And then, you know, in 3 weeks when you go to eat your kraut, then every time you're eating a meal on the run, you can make it a much more nutritionally significant meal by putting a little bit of sauerkraut on it.
It's interesting to me that when we use the word ferment in relationship to ideas and actions in life, actual fermentation, you say that as a force for change, fermentation is quite gentle.
I mean, fermentation, you know, can be profoundly transformative. You know, like the soy sauce that you have after a year bears very little resemblance to the soybeans that you begin with. If you think about walking into a cheese shop, you know, all those different cheeses that you see are made from the same ingredient. And they've all departed from the original ingredient of milk in different ways, depending on, you know, the fermentation environment and the, you know, techniques by which the milk has been manipulated. So the transformations wrought by fermentation can be really dramatic, both in, you know, literal fermentation and in figurative fermentation. But if we compare it to, you know, other transformative phenomenon. And, you know, the most obvious comparison to me is comparing it to fire. You know, you can burn your food to a crisp in a matter of minutes, whereas the transformation from fermentation is a much slower and gentler fermentation. And I think that when we think about metaphorical fermentation and the idea of fermentation being a driving force in social change, it's a gentler mode of social transformation than, you know, what we could think of analogous to fire, which is, you know, just like burn the whole thing down and start from scratch. The transformations wrought by fermentation just tend to be slower and more gentle. But also, you know, fermentation is a force that is unstoppable. So there's a certain, you know, steadiness and inevitability to transform it to fermentation as a transformative force.
You were just finishing up this volume when COVID hit. what thoughts did this new challenge add to your reflections?
It was very interesting. I mean, I really submitted my manuscript like just as COVID hit. And then I kind of realized that, you know, it was germane and I needed to, I needed to address it in some ways. So, I mean, one thing that I talk about a good deal in the book is the war on bacteria, the idea that, you know, people have become afraid of bacteria and people often project that fear onto the process of fermentation. You know, through the years, the question I've heard more than any other question is, how can I be sure that I have good bacteria growing in my jar of cabbage and not some dangerous bacteria that might make me sick or even kill somebody? So, you know, a lot of people just can't help themselves from, you know, projecting this anxiety onto this time-tested, extremely safe process. You know, the COVID period is sort of, you know, bringing us into moving from the war on bacteria to the war on viruses. But, you know, in a way, it's just an intensification of the war on bacteria. I guess one of my interests is making sure that we don't just demonize viruses as an entire group, the way we've demonized bacteria, because, you know, I think that it's to our detriment when we, sort of decide that a form of life is bad and needs to be destroyed. You know, if we consider them a form of life, viruses are by far the most numerous forms of life. There are more viruses than there are all other forms of life combined. And, you know, one of the practical benefits that we humans get from viruses is that, you know, they're a major factor in keeping bacteria in balance, because the largest of viruses are thought to be phages, which manifest as diseases for bacteria. So, you know, in our bodies and in other environments of the earth, you know, viral populations are part of what are, you know, keeping bacterial populations in check. So, I mean, I just think we can't think of forms of life as being, you know, bad or good. You know, they exist, and they're, you know, we're all part of this, you know, elaborate co-evolutionary relationship, and we all, you know, exist, you know, in relation to one another.
Thank you so much, Sandor.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.
I've been meditating on fermentation and life with Sandor Katz. His latest book, Fermentation as Metaphor, is available now. Coming up, celebrating Black excellence in American food. Chef Marcus Samuelson is here next. Stay close.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. Black excellence has long been celebrated in popular culture. Think sports, music, literature, and film. So why the delay in the culinary industry to recognize the contributions of Black cooks and innovators? Marcus Samuelson shines the spotlight on the movement to recognize the achievements and influence of those behind Black food in America. Hi, Marcus.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
That's a very loaded question, but I think I'm about to be okay, but I'm okay. It's just been a lot.
Yeah, it's been too much. You've asked the question, Black is not a taste, or is it? What is the rise and the three pillars on which it stands?
The rise is really an opportunity to really reshape and bring back the authorship of Black food, really unpack it in a way, because it's told so wrong if you even can find it. So I felt it was important to talk about authorship, to talk about memory, and also aspirations, right? Because if there's no worth, if the value proposition of who makes the stuff, where does the stuff comes from, is off, you don't know anything of its memories, and you don't know anything of, you can't create aspirations, right? So if you talk about, hey, I want to give you a box of Belgian chocolate, but there's no cocoa beans in Belgium. They're all in Ghana. So every time we rephrase that to Belgium, that level of excellence, we write out of the history the process of making chocolate and cocoa in Africa, right? We've done it with coffee forever. We've said, oh, I want that French roast coffee or that Italian coffee is amazing. But the coffee beans, we know it comes from Ethiopia and Kenya. And we don't do that with any European product. We don't say that Mercedes come from Nigeria. We don't say that Apple was invented by Ethiopia. We wouldn't be dare to say that. So it's important to name the place where the food comes from. That then connects a level of excellence and aspirations. The second part is, of course, what memories do you connect to this? If the memories are never connected back to its source, you can never get excellence out of that. You can never get that level of respect. I'll give you another example. Nearest Green, he created the recipe for Jack Daniels. He didn't make a dime. Imagine if Nearest Green would have been compensated for doing that. How many other people, Black people, would have gone into bourbon making? What would that would have done for both wealth, but also for the worth of bourbon in the culture? How many jobs that would have created? So it is meaningful to have the authorship and the ownership back. And starting point has to be corrected.
You invite people into this deep conversation as a listening party, and the parallels to the expansiveness of music are so apt. You say people talk about fried chicken and grits as where soul food stops, as if in music we stopped studying African music at bebop and didn't continue to listen to and appreciate hip-hop or Afrobeat, reggae, and funk. It's a very powerful metaphor.
You know, for me, I was struggling with how do I link this book so, you know, people like my sister and people who are into food would understand it, but not just food nerds like myself would be into it, right? How do I connect? And music for me was the strongest linkage, right? Because it's so clear to me that you cannot speak about American pop culture without talking about the Black experience. But people actually speaking about American food experience without labeling and talking about Black chefs. So when there are three specific things that comes from the African-American experience, right? Low country, you know, from South and North Carolina. You have obviously really incredible Creole cooking, you know, connected to the city of New Orleans. And then, of course, what we think about in terms of Southern food wouldn't have happened without the Black experience, right? So there's modern food that has been pillars of American, original American cuisines that we should know more about. And we should know who were the kings and queens who created that. What was their names? The way we learned the masters of French cooking or Italian cooking.
What does it mean to be the Black cook in America today?
I think it can mean many things, right? And that was important that the people in the Rise, the over 150 people we highlight, this is not a list of who's in, who made or who didn't make it. It's not like that. It's about explaining many narratives, right? Someone like Queen, like Miss Leah Chase, right? That was both an advocate and she was truly Black Lives Matters of cooking, right? She was breaking the law, serving Black and white people. She was a tribe leader in New Orleans in terms of always staying on the block, hiring locally. So you have people like that. But then you have also people like Marvin Woods that has just been a great professional in the industry. He's done every aspect of the industry. He's been a caterer. He's owned a restaurant. He's closed a restaurant. He's been a sous chef. So that, you know, there's more people like Marvin Woods in our industry that are incredible that might get a little bump, but will never get on the nationwide stage. There's also people like Mashama Bailey that I feel got next, can be the next major, major food star in America. She's already known, but she's an incredible talent. Aisha Arrington, that is both African-American and Korean-American, right? So it's important to talk about the complexity of Blackness, right? Black is not just through the migration. It's also through immigration like myself. And then it's also through the Caribbean, right? Like someone like Greg Gaudet from Haiti cooks extremely different food than someone like Tavel Bristol Joseph that cooks in Austin that has Guyanese background. So that's my point, that Black, what does it taste like? It's not monolithic. It's layered. It's complex.
You ask a really interesting question in the chapter that focuses on migration. You ask yourself, in terms of food, with so many options in front of you of creativity, what do I bring forward and what do I allow to live in the past?
Mm. Well, I do think that as a chef with a large platform, I have a responsibility to guide people and to bring people to the space, but also to broadcast people's stories that I feel are very undertold, right? And in order to understand great art or great cooking, you have to build from something. You know, out of jazz, out of rock and roll, and out of James Brown comes hip hop and so on, right? It's all built and layered. When it comes to Black food, we do the same, but I'm not sure if it gets articulated and broadcasted in a way so the diner can also follow with that. You know, how do you explain the food of Tiana G, 24 years old, both Filipino-American and African-American? And this is common. You know, Jerome Grant in Washington, D.C. is also Filipino and Jamaican-American, right? So this language with BIPOC and Black gets mixed up. They have the right to cook their food. Of course they do. They draw from the grandparents. They draw from the parents. So this is a new language, right? The way we understand, you know, music, the way we understand literature, there are new languages. And for me, it's important that our diner, our guest that wants to be engaged and informed, that they understand that Black food is not linear. It has a very, very layered and complex journey, right? Where it came from out of Africa, where it moved through the migration, how it got reshipped back, how it got married away. And that also why it's so delicious. The fact that we have ties both to Latin, Asian, Caribbean. I'm not sure that it's been broadcasted and told enough times. That's why it's important to do that.
So much of this book has really made me think. You talk about how recipes are rituals, and I was thinking that recipes are like written instructions to rituals, but the actual act of cooking them is so fluid, and it's an individual doing it. So they take everything they are and everything they're interested in, and they talk with their hands to adapt and change.
You know, when I think about recipes as rituals, I thought a lot about this because, you know, I'm the fourth best Ethiopian cook in my house. Right. And when I think about my wife and her sisters, when they do cook Ethiopian food, they don't look at any recipes ever. It's all rituals. And it's a rhythm that is so clear to them. And I always feel as an outsider looking in, the way they make the butter, the way they make the yogurt, the way they make the injera bread. It's all rituals. And then I started thinking about when the enslaved people came over here, very few things were written down. There were rituals. I look at how someone like Rodney Scott deals with the fire, how he smokes his hogs. It's all rituals. To get a recipe from Rodney is very difficult, but to follow Rodney is fluid, right? So the rituals has been around for thousands and thousands of years. Recipe itself is quite young. And I think about how I got trained. I look at my wife's cooking. It's all ritual. She never looked at a recipe. I looked at my grandmother's cooking. It's all rituals, right? How she cured, how she smoked, all rituals. My grandmother never looked at a recipe. Then I got trained in France and Switzerland, all recipes, right? It got more male. It tried to get more precise. So finding that balance between ritual and recipes is key. But you can't, just because you find a recipe, don't rip the soul out of the food. So it's a balance, right, between how do I technically actually do that? What's the ritual? How do I respect that? How does a ritual really inform what I want to make with this recipe? So thinking about food as ritual, thinking about food as terroir, thinking about almost tribal, I just find that as a different space to talk about food, and I find it very interesting.
How do we continue? How do those of us who are eaters and readers, how can we help to create equity in the food landscape?
I think there's a couple of places, right? I think doing exactly what you're doing right now, leaning in, asking questions, broadcasting, that's one very, very, very important part of it. Number two, as we're having this nationwide conversation about race, and we want to be allies and we want to help out, cook the food, eat the food. What would be more interesting and needed right now but to actually cook and eat and break bread? The way we learn how to cook Italian food, the way we learn how to bring in Persian food into our home or Middle Eastern food to our home, this is our food. It's out of African-American culture, but it's our food. It's America's food. So we've done it with music, right? We did it with Aretha. We've done it with Stevie. We've done it with so many incredible American African-American musicians. It's nothing strange if you put some black music on when you throw a party. It's the same thing here.
Thank you, Marcus. This has been just another wonderful conversation with you. The book is fascinating on so many levels. The one part we didn't talk about is the food, which looks just wonderful. I can't wait to cook
the
from it.
The food. Can we talk about the food? Can we talk? The food is incredible. There's a soup there called Soup Jumoon, which is just a pumpkin soup, but it's also Haiti's independent soup. So think about you cooking a normal pumpkin soup, but this is the independent soup of Haiti. That easy you can travel to Haiti, right? Or the Sunday roast chicken with couscous. We're just taking great butter and sage and berbere, and we're putting it under the skin and we're roasting it. And it's a wonderful, wonderful roasted chicken.
I just have to say that there's page after page after page of great stories we need to learn, and what better way than to make the food that tells the story.
Yes, cook the food, get into the rice, and thank you so much for having me.
That's Marcus Samuelson, chef and host of No Passport Required. We've been talking about Black food in America. His book, written with Osai Endolin, is The Rise. In a minute, as traditional restaurants are closing, a new type of food entrepreneurship is on the rise. We hear about both sides of that coin next. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. There's so much to unpack about restaurants. There's the cultural importance and hospitality as it affects giver and receiver. Then there's the business, the money, which acts as red corpuscles, delivering oxygen and health so that culture and hospitality can thrive. The pandemic shows us what happens when that vitality is gone completely. But in this moment of chaos, there's also clarity for many who have made a life in restaurants. The clarity is about the diminishing odds of winning in normal times, let alone now when so many are hobbled. So when Andy Ricker announced the closing of his flagship restaurant, Pock Pock, in Portland, it felt like another pandemic blow. But there's more to this story than that, and I'm so grateful to have Andy Ricker with us. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Evan.
Tell us where you're talking to us from.
I'm calling you from Bangkok, Thailand. I've moved to Thailand permanently after many, many years of traveling back and forth and staying for months at a time. I happen to live in Chiang Mai, but I'm down in Bangkok to do a food festival.
I'm curious, what was your original intention that led you to open Pok Pok in 2005?
My original intention to open Pok Pok was basically present the food that I had been seeing and eating in Thailand for, you know, many, many years that I had a hard time finding back in Portland specifically and, you know, in the West generally. Lots of dishes that I would go to Thailand, I'd try this thing and I'd come back and I'd look for it on a menu of a local Thai restaurant and I wouldn't be able to find it. And it's not that those dishes didn't exist in America. It was just that it was a bit opaque back in the early, the 90s and the 2000s and, you know, before, unless you lived in Los Angeles and were in the know.
At that point in time, were you someone who you would consider a chef? Were you a cook? What was your restaurant experience at that time?
So at the time of opening Pok Pok in 2005, I'd already been in the restaurant business for about, 20 years or so on and off. I started my first cooking job when I was 16, and I basically supported myself as a cook until sort of the late 90s when I took a little break and I was a house painter for about 8 years. But I remain connected to restaurants because I painted a lot of restaurants. So, in one way or another, I've been connected or involved in or worked in or owned restaurants for my whole adult life.
How many restaurants did you have when the restaurant was at the largest phase of expansion?
I think at any given time, the most that we've ever had in play is 8 restaurants. I mean, restaurants came and went. It's not like I opened a zillion restaurants and then closed them all at once. You know, restaurants came and went over the years, but I think at the height of it when we had both restaurants in New York, LA, and Portland, I think 8 in number was the highest we ever got.
So let's talk about what happened coming up to the pandemic. You had already started to close some restaurants. And what was your kind of emotional feeling about still being in the business? Was it something you were still fired up about? Or were you basically there because you felt beholden to all the people you worked with?
I think it was the latter more than the former. I basically, I think probably around 2 or 3 years ago, and I started feeling less enamored of the restaurant business than ever before in my life. I could see that continuing to run a restaurant group of this size without any partners as the sole owner was probably going to be detrimental to both my mental and physical health. It probably already is, has been, will be for a while. And you know, that coupled with the fact that the economic fortunes that we, had been experienced were in decline, it seemed like a good idea to start shrinking the number of stores that we had and the amount of the size of our team. But that was going to be a methodical, slow march towards eventually maybe only owning Pok Pok and maybe having the lease on Whiskey Soda Lounge across the street maintained. And in the midst of that, we had this very nice surprise, which is we opened this thing called Ping Yang Pao, which was kind of a little restaurant inside of a restaurant at our Northwest location that was, cooking everything on live fire, small menu. The chefs were serving the customers, and it felt really good, and it was very well received. And I kind of wanted to keep that going. That felt like kind of a new exciting thing. But unfortunately, of course, as soon as COVID hit, that was the first thing to close. Just we couldn't, there's no way you can do that in a pandemic.
I think what's so interesting about your arc to so many of us is that you rode this last wave of restaurants from start to finish, really, if you think of the pandemic as being at least a temporary finish. Could you just kind of talk on that, about that emotional arc of how the external culture of food in the world changed?
Obviously, because I've been involved in the restaurant world heavily for the last 15 years, I've kind of been in part involved in that and part and parcel of it. I guess what happens over time is that the innocence of what you're, you know, and the idealism that a certain sort of like movement starts with typically gets lost over time. So, you know, 15 years ago, we're able to open a restaurant making really good food, and you have this sort of idealistic view of what it means and how you're going to go about it, and without a ton of experience in doing it. And then as time goes by, it becomes more and more based on the economics of things, and you're forced to like get yourself involved with social media, and you run around doing TV shows, and then all of a sudden a lot of other people are doing it. You got to remember that you know, in 15 years we saw the number of small independent restaurants doing interesting stuff go from very, very small amounts to like a huge amount, right? And you know, a lot of the negative things that have always been true about restaurants are always there. You know, they'll always be there as long as there are human beings in restaurants. You're going to have the same socio-political problems that you have in the rest of society. And you know, in a lot of ways, restaurants can be a boiler room for that, just because it's a high intensity environment. You know, I personally, you know, had a manifesto from the very start, which was that I grew up in a very, you know, if you've read Kitchen Confidential, the way Tony Bourdain describes being a line cook, that's the reason why that book resonated so well with so many people of cooks of my generation, is because he was describing pretty much exactly the environment that I came up in, right? And many, many other people did as well. And when I opened Pock Pock, I was like, I don't want that. You know, I don't want a situation where the chef's throwing a frying pan across the room and the waiters and the kitchen are in adversarial roles, and there's people being teased because of their gender or their sexual preference or their race or the way they look or anything like that, because that was brutal, you know? And I didn't want to have anything to do with that. So at Pock Pock, we had policies in place that basically said, this is not okay, you know, and we're not going to allow this to happen. So, you know, we always had that in mind, but, you know, there's also the sort of like inherent kind of creeping biases that happen in, you know, from everywhere, from me to the dishwasher. Any industry, not just restaurants, but right now, any industry has to be very sort of self-reflective about how we've operated for many, many years. And it's, you know, it's a hard place to be.
So given that we know there's so many issues surrounding restaurants, what does the future of restaurants look like to you?
I said in my little post I think that the next wave of restaurants needs to be reimagined by the next generation of restaurant owners. And unfortunately, on the post, that one sentence got clipped off the bottom, and I'm not sure, you know, how that happened. But I really do believe that restaurants will come back in some sort of form. And I believe that the next generation really needs to imagine what it is that they want out of their restaurant, running it and working at them, because the way that restaurants have been run to date are based on an old model, which basically says you have to, you know, you have to work like hell for a long time for not much money to gain the skills in order to have the experience to do this. You know, and a lot of problems arise from this. You know, the problem of pay inequality, the problems of discrimination, of abuse, all that kind of stuff rise from this sort of like really sort of like hardcore way of doing things. And that's how I came up. And though I tried to mitigate that in our restaurants, I don't really know the right way to go forward in order to achieve what people really want in a restaurant. So I'm hoping that the new generation will have some ideas about how to go about doing that. And, you know, I wish them all the luck in the world. I hope that we can find a way to have workspaces that are equitable and all people feel safe in them, and that, you know, simultaneously, you can also have excellence and a well-run business.
That's Chef Andy Ricker. We've been talking about his decision to end the 15-year run of his Pock Pock restaurant group. Amidst all the doom and gloom news about independent restaurants, I see a silver lining. Entrepreneurs who harbored a talent and a dream to share their food are launching small, quirky food businesses in record numbers. Before the pandemic, you couldn't find Bali-styled bungkus in Los Angeles. But when COVID left sisters Celine and Tara Carrara without jobs, they decided to start selling the Indonesian specialty from their driveway. Celine and Tara share their story with us for this week's edition of In the Weeds.
My name is Celine Carrara, and I am one of the sisters behind Bungkus Bagus LA.
My name's Tara Carrara. I'm the younger sister of Bungkus Bagus LA.
We serve traditional Balinese street food wrapped up in a banana leaf.
In Bahasa Indonesia, which is the language of Bali and Indonesia, bungkus is a loose word for any kind of package. So basically, the bungkus itself is like a little gift. So it's wrapped in a wax paper, and then when you open it, there's a banana leaf inside that protects all of the food and keeps it from spilling out. So in a way, it's similar to like an empanada or a burrito in that like it's its own little house, which makes it great to eat on the go and is why it's such a popular street food, not only in Bali, but in all of Indonesia, because, you know, people ride motorbikes. You can just pull up to the warung, to the corner store, get your bungkus, eat it on your bike and go.
Inside our bungkus are actually a myriad of different little goodies. We've got coconut lemongrass rice in the center. Rice is the staple ingredient to all bungkus that you'd find. And in addition to that, we have a slow-cooked coconut curry with chicken and a sayur arab, which is a fresh long bean and bean sprout kind of salad with freshly grated coconuts. There's kanchur, which is an amazing brother to ginger almost in terms of flavor. We also have tempeh olek, which is a deep fried soybean. It's deep fried in a kind of chili oil, so it's spicy, covered in a chili glaze. And then a mother-in-law egg, which is a hard-boiled egg that then gets soaked in soy sauce with a dollop of chili on top. And then last but not least is our sambal, which sambal goreng is deep-fried chilies, deep-fried garlic, and shallots with a ton of salt. So there's a lot to play with when you open up our bungkus. Some of my earliest childhood memories are centered around Balinese cooking. So our parents, our dad was an old hippie, our mom a flight attendant, and they met on the island, fell in love and got together, had us, and lived in a traditional Balinese compound. So our neighbors were local people making breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I could scoot over there as a three-year-old and grab some food. So my initial palate really as a kid was all about rice and chili. And I've been cooking and trying to figure out how to make these dishes really ever since. The circumstances that led us to open up a food business really were the pandemic. Tara was living in New York back in February working as a makeup artist, and I was here in Los Angeles working as a doula. And it just so happened that when the pandemic struck, Tara was here in Los Angeles on work and ended up moving into our childhood home and just stayed. And we were out of work trying to figure out what to do. We could only kind of clean and come up with weird, odd jobs and projects for so long. Food has always been something that really brought us together and that I think deepens our connection and how we get to play together as adults. And with some encouragement from our partners, we thought, why not do a pop-up? Let's see how it goes. If anything, our friends and family are going to come because they've already been eating this food and they really love it. And the surprise and the reaction that we've gotten is really way more than we could have imagined.
A great moment that I think sums up being a food entrepreneur during the pandemic was when one of our high school friends came by, and he's a very loyal customer. He's ordered pretty much every time. And his dad spent a lot of time in Bali, I think during the 80s. And he said, you guys, like, this food made my dad cry because it reminded him so much of his old life. And I just had this feeling of what a special place we get to be in where we have such an intimate connection with our customers. Because we're all so alienated from each other, because it's so hard to meet in person, when you do have that chance to be together in community, it has so much more weight to it. And I feel like we get to be, you know, sort of like the diner where you know the guy behind the counter, except that, like, we know everybody. And that is such a gift that we get to have, even though we're not a traditional restaurant, we get to have a closeness with our customers that is really special.
Are we going to go back to doing what we did before the pandemic hit, or are we going to stick to the Bunku's job? I think that's an interesting question, and I think at this particular moment, Tara and I are trying to decide. I can't imagine not making Bunku's on the weekends for people now. So looking ahead, we are trying to come up with a vision that continues to honor the tradition of making Bunku's. So whether that means opening up a warung or doing some kind of, you know, like pop-in pickup window, these are things that we're considering. And I think as the restaurant industry is changing as a result of COVID, we have new opportunity to make it whatever we want it to be.
If you come to the next pop-up, I mean, this is a bit of a cop-out, but order everything. We have a small menu. We have the Bunku's, which is the sort of the main dish. But then we also sell our sambal on the side, which, depending on how much you love it, can last you a couple days, a week, 2 weeks, until the next pop-up. We've got forbidden rice pudding. We're also hoping to add a sort of dessert drink called es chendol, which is similar to halo halo in Filipino cuisine. It's kind of like a drinkable dessert with lots of goodies in it. But I would say don't skip out on the sambal, because it really, I think, is the sort of secret star of the show.
That was Celine and Tara Carrara, the sisters behind Bunku's Bagus. We've got the market report next. Stick around for a taste of persimmon cream puffs when Good Food continues. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Fall fruit continues to pour into Southern California farmers markets. Jillian Ferguson has the update on what you should be shopping for this first weekend in November.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. We are recording this week from the Culver City Farmers Market on Main Street in downtown Culver City. And I'm talking with Gemma Matsuyama. Gemma, you've had a really interesting career. You were at Nikki Nakayama's in Naka as the pastry chef, and now you're at Ototo in Oko Park. And both of these restaurants are Japanese restaurants that rely heavily on California seasonal produce. So tell us what you're shopping for this week now that the weather is turning a little bit cooler.
Right now, I'm all about persimmons, quince, citrus, and squashes. So right now, we have a bunch of cream puffs served at Ototo, which is like my favorite pastry to make. It's why I actually started baking, was cream puffs for my dad when I was like 12. And this week, I'm still featuring persimmons. And I am featuring Hachia persimmons, which is like the really ripe, juicy kind that's gonna be like in as a sauce as in the center, and then fresh Fuyu persimmons and some sauteed persimmons inside the cream. So
you brought up the two different kinds. We have the astringent persimmons, which are the Hachias. Talk about how you find the right ripeness for those, because you almost wanna get them so that they're pretty much falling apart, oh,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So the hachillas are really particular. They have a lot of tannins inside when they're not ripe to keep the animals away, basically, from getting into them because they're so delicious. And then once they're super ripe, you can feel it's just like a mush, and it feels like a very overripe tomato. And I learned this from my Korean friends, where they put the ripened persimmon in the freezer and you eat it as is, and it tastes just like sherbet. Like,
oh,
it's like sorbet, the creamiest thing. There's a lot of sugar content that doesn't freeze completely even though it's in the freezer, so it's a great organic snack that you can have. So I love using the two kinds of persimmons in Japanese culture. We eat it as is, the Fuyu persimmons, crunchy, just skin off. And because we take off the skin, I like to take the skin and infuse it in the vanilla pastry cream and cut back on some of the added sugar and enhance the natural sweetness of the persimmons.
Wow, okay. So talk about how you're making this persimmon filling. Is it persimmon and like a vanilla custard at the same time?
Yeah, it's a simple vanilla pastry cream, but I'll add in the skins of the persimmon that I peel and let it infuse overnight, and it just gives it a really light, nice aroma. So you can add more layers to it and give it like that persimmon punch.
And so much of the fun of cream puffs is how it's decorated on top. How do you decorate the top of the persimmon ones?
The persimmon ones have a cookie crust with Sonora wheat from Tehachapi Grain Project. I love using whole grains, ancient grains, to add more nutritional value and flavor to baked goods. For the cream puffs, I add it as a topping to add that little crisp. And then it's piped with some vanilla whipped cream and a fresh Fuyu persimmon diced up as well. I curl it to make it look like a rose and then fill it with a hachiya filling.
Wow, that sounds so beautiful. Yeah. So are all of your cream puffs always filled with seasonal ingredients?
I try my best, and I'm really influenced by the farmers market here in California. It's so abundant all year round. And although people from out of state are like, well, you don't celebrate all the seasons, there's actually so much going on. So I love going to the different markets, learning a little bit about the farmers' background, what they have, and working around those products.
Absolutely. Well, I just discovered Ototo's grocery option, which is amazing. You can get all these great Japanese pantry items and all the good sake that was on the menu pre-COVID. And now I know that we can get your cream puffs and your other pastries too. So Gemma, thank you so much.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you so much for having me.
That was Gemma Matsuyama. She is the pastry chef at Ototo, where you can get her cream puffs in Echo Park. Ryan Ramones is part of Ramones Family Farm, where Gemma is buying her persimmons this week. And Ryan, you and your family grow a huge variety of fruits and vegetables up in Tulare County. Tell us how many acres you have and how your family got into growing.
Yeah, it's about 7 acres. My father, he wanted to have his own farm. And about almost 3 years, we started. He got the land and he quit his old job. And here we are.
So that was just 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah. We probably could have got the farm before, but my mom want me and my brother to finish school.
Okay.
So everything they're doing now is for me and my brother and or for our family. It's pretty cool.
So you have a number of fruit trees on the farm, including persimmons. Tell us about what variety you grow.
So the variety I grow of persimmons is called Fuyu. Yeah, it's this small, almost looking pumpkin, almost tomato looking, but it's orange, and it's so good. The flavor for a persimmon, it's almost like a pumpkin. If you ever like pumpkin spice and you can't find a pumpkin anywhere, persimmons are a good substitute.
When we come to the market and we're picking out our Fuyu persimmons, what are we looking for?
Oh, you look for the orange. Yeah, if it's more orange or even the darker it is, It's a little more riper, but like some you could eat it like really hard, like an apple. It's almost like a Fuji apple. It's crisp, it's sweet. You can also wait for it to get soft, and that's really, really good too. I don't know, I think it's at its best when it's kind of soft and just like a soft like pear. Mm. Yeah, just like that.
Okay. And when we get home, should we put them in the refrigerator or leave them out on the counter?
If you want them to ripen, I would just leave them in the calendar for a couple of days, just check on them. And it's a nice decoration too. It's like a mini pumpkin. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And to keep it longer, yeah, I'll keep them in the fridge. They'll last about a couple of weeks there.
Before I let you go, I have to ask you about your other crops, because you're also quite well known for all the Asian vegetables you bring. Maybe you can pick one vegetable that's on your table today that's unique to you and your family, and tell us how you grow it and how you like to eat it.
I'm not sure if a lot of people know this, but it's called the moringa. It's a delicious herb. It's great benefits, help with diabetes, lower blood sugar. It's so good. And if you can do research, you can see it's a superfood.
How do you eat it?
Oh, the thing about the moringa, it's these tiny leaves, tiny, tiny leaves. So much of it, you have to pluck them all out. It takes time, but it's worth it.
And do you make a tea or do you eat them fresh in a salad?
You can boil them, make tea. You can eat them raw. You can dry them. You can put them in your salad. You can put them in your smoothies, your shakes. There's so many great things about this one, too.
Well, Ryan, it's great to see you here at the Culver City Market. Thanks for taking the time to talk.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me here.
That was Ryan Ramones. He is one of the farmers at Ramones Family Farm up in Tulare County. You can find them at the Tuesday Culver City Market and at the Saturday Torrance Farmers Market. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
Before I go, I'd love to hear from you what your Thanksgiving plans are this year. Are you roasting a turkey? Are you getting takeout? Are you sticking your head in the sand? Please send me a note on Twitter or Instagram. My DMs are open, and you can always reach us by email at goodfood@kcrw.org. My thanks during a tough week to the Good Food team. Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, and Desmond Taylor. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, Gary Masiha, and Kenny Ng. Has this week lasted an entire year? If you find yourself stressed, then by all means, eat a cream puff. Order one of those bungus, or do what I do and make yourself a plate of nachos. And be kind to yourself and to others. I'll be back next week with more good food.